This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com. Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Toastmasters Podcast. My name is Bo Bennett.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
And we've got another great show for you today. Ryan, who are we speaking with?
Our guest today is Scott Birkin. Scott quit his regular job in 2003 to make a living writing full-time. His work as a writer and public speaker has appeared in The New York Times, The Washington Post, Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Guardian, Wired Magazine, National Public Radio, The Huffington Post, and other media. Scott has taught at the University of Washington. He blogs for Harvard Business and Business Week, and he's appeared frequently as an innovation expert on CNBC and MSNBC. Scott's the author of three best-selling books, Making Things Happen, The Myths of Innovation, and Confessions of a Public Speaker. And that last title, Confessions of a Public Speaker, is also the title of an article that was in the 2010 September 2010 issue of the Toastmaster magazine, an excerpt from his book here. So, Mr. Scott Birkin, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Welcome, Scott.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show. So, Scott, your book, I've read your article here and also actually read a good portion of your book online thanks to Amazon's preview. Very good stuff. Really excited to chat with you today.
So you read part of the book, but you didn't pay for it.
They give the free preview. And, right. You know, hey, I checked it out. It looks really good. So we've got a few things we want to chat with you about related to your book and your experiences. But Scott, obviously you're someone who's attending conferences all the time as a speaker and a presenter. I'm just curious, what are some of the things you observe, mistakes that other presenters are frequently making?
It's surprising. This is a very basic thing. I know it's something that Toastmasters talked about a lot, but in the professional world, at events and all kinds of professions, the number one thing that's very easy to spot is simply people who haven't practiced. They've spent a lot of time on their slides. They spend a lot of time writing up their notes, but it's pretty clear when they get confused by their own material that they haven't actually practiced very much. And it's the most basic thing in the world, but everyone has so much fear around actually even practicing speaking that they think there's some way around it. And for the most part, there isn't. So that's got to be the number one. It's just I can spot people very quickly. I'm like, wow, clearly you haven't done this before because you would never have made a mistake like that one if you had even walked through your material just once.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. And that's pretty much public speaking 101, isn't it?
It is, but you know, there's this thing about being good at almost any skill in the world that there's a lot of basic things that you have to do, and they're not necessarily fun things or exciting things,
right?
But they just sort of have to be done,
yeah.
And you can see that in writing, or in managing people, or in a thousand different professions. There's always a couple of basic things that it's kind of shocking, but a lot of people think that they can skip and not have to do,
right. Well, you know, as someone who also attends conferences, I notice a lot of times there are presenters who seem like this is just kind of off the cuff, and they make it look so easy. And so I think maybe sometimes people just think, oh, well, I'll just feed off the energy of the audience and, you know, I'll be like that. But
there's definitely something deceptive about seeing a very good speaker that it seems so natural, and they're working very hard to make it seem that way. But it's not – it's kind of an illusion. It's sort of like when we see a comedian on television or on the Tonight Show or whatever, we see a comedian do their five-minute routine, and they work very hard to make it seem like that's just how they are, that they
right.
walk around all day long, and they just make funny commentary about everything, and it just builds naturally. Somehow it's just something innate in them. But if you actually talk to any comedian, they'll tell you that it takes them months and months of work.
Right.
Of practicing the same 5 minutes and the same 10 minutes to get it to seem so effortless.
Right.
So there's some, discordance about how what we see as a in the audience and what we're led to believe about what's involved. And I think that confuses some people.
Yeah, I could definitely see as a new public speaker seeing somebody in the audience and just saying, hey, I could do that. And just getting up and doing it and realizing you can't. You know, because you skip
it
the
looks
major
so easy.
Step, right? Of all the work. Well, Scott, I loved your article in the Toastmasters magazine because I think it's really what many public speakers are worried about, like all of these different issues that people are worried about. And what you have done in that article is just address them pretty much one by one. So let's go over a few of those. And I think that's going to be a good start to this, starting with the heckling.
I'm wondering also, like, how often do you as a presenter run into hecklers? Is this just like a really rare phenomenon, or is this happening all the time?
It depends entirely on where you speak. I think for almost everyone listening to this podcast or who's affiliated with Toastmasters, you'll probably go your entire life and never be heckled. Mm-hmm. It's such a rare thing. If you are speaking to the audience that has chosen to come there and you've chosen your topic well and you've rehearsed a little bit, it's incredibly rare that you'll have someone who stands up in the middle of your presentation and starts yelling at you.
Right.
it just doesn't happen. People aren't like that. If you're a politician, if you're speaking about a volatile topic, if you are on the street and you're speaking to people who aren't choosing to listen to you, or if you're at a bar and you're a stand-up comedian, that changes the environment, and that makes people feel like they have more of a right to interrupt what you're doing. And then it's more likely. But that's pretty rare. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I've probably given hundreds of lectures. I've had like actual hecklers a handful of times, maybe, you know, 7 or 8 times. I've had more, you know, moderate things happen where someone stands up with a question and they're asking a polite question, but they're interrupting what I'm doing. And that's sort of like heckling in that it's disturbing, that it's disruptive rather. But even that's kind of rare, especially if you as a speaker ask the audience to hold their questions to the end, which is something that any speaker could choose to do.
Right.
So it is really rare. A lot of people ask me about that and that they're afraid of it. And that's part of why they think they're afraid of speaking. But statistically speaking, it's astronomically unlikely for most people.
To be heckled, right? I think one of the things that you mentioned in there is what could be thrown in with heckling, and that's, as we dubbed it, kind of the grandstanding. An audience member taking up your time to share their story or just to throw their 2 cents in, like not realizing it's kind of a speech. It's, you know, it's a one-way communication.
In the Q&A, you see the same thing. Someone
right.
who's getting up under the guise of asking a question, but really they just want to rant and rave for 5 minutes about their pet cause.
Right. Well, let me tell you about my new book.
So in all cases, whether it's actually a heckler or someone who interrupts you or the person who has the rambling 5-minute question, the thing that you have to remember as a speaker is that the people chose to come and listen to you or listen to the topic that you chose to speak about. And that means that you're kind of in charge. Unless you've done something very bad, you're in charge, and the audience is depending on you to maintain the decorum in the room.
Mm-hmm.
That means if someone's cell phone goes off and they start talking on it, well, who's gonna ask them to stop? It's not going to be the random audience member. It's going to be you as the speaker. You have the microphone, which means you have control over the room. So if someone asks me a question in the middle of a presentation and I really don't want to answer it now, I'll say, thank you for the question. I'll answer it at the end. They'll sit down, and I've maintained decorum over the room. Mm-hmm. So with the rambler, with the person who at the end during Q&A starts going, and 30 seconds into the question, I know he hasn't asked a question yet. He's just getting started.
Right.
Then I'm the only person in the room who can do anything. And the thing to do is what everyone in the audience probably wants me to do, which is to interrupt him and say, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but can you shape this into a question? And if they stumble, I say, okay, that's fine. I'll come back to you. And then I'll go to the next question. And I'll give him a chance to rethink his ramble into the form of something that actually ends with a question mark.
Right.
And if he can, I'll come back. And if not, then I've moved on. And it also helps set the tone for everyone else now that a 5-minute ramble is just not going to be tolerated in the room as long as I'm at the front of it. I'm just setting the rules.
Right.
And I think that's really what people want. They don't want to – they didn't come to listen to some person talk about their book or their pet dog or what happened to them on the way to work that morning, which sometimes people often it's unintentional. Sometimes people just end up rambling.
People are talkative. What can you say? Yeah. Well, let's talk about something that's definitely more common, and that's the whole bad vibe feeling. Anybody who's been in speaking has definitely felt this. You go into a room to give a speech, a presentation, and you just do not feel like the audience is very receptive to your message. It may start at the very beginning, or maybe it's well into your speech. You feel like the audience is turning on you. What do you do in a situation like that?
Find the exit.
And excuse me, and just run.
Just run. They'll forget you were even there. They'll go home early, and they'll call it a good day.
All right, next question.
Well, a better answer is I know from experience that it's hard in the moment to really gauge whether you're in a hostile room or not. Mm-hmm. That there's so much going on. There's so much it's very difficult to gauge that. And if you speak in different countries, different parts of the world where the culture is different, some of that's just the cultural norms. If you're in Japan or in Scandinavia, people just don't respond very much to whatever a speaker does. They won't laugh at jokes. They won't really applaud very much. That's just normal for them. It has more to do with their culture and what's normal for them than it does to do with how good a job I did. So whenever I get up in front of a crowd, I have this filter on my sense of the vibe, which is, you know what? I might be wrong about the vibe. So I can't bet too much on what this vibe is that I'm reading. I have to assume that I planned well. I assume that I prepared well. I just go ahead with the show that I plan to do. The other thing that helps a ton is to know who the person is who invited you in to speak and to talk to them that day before you show up. If you get there early, you can do it then and say, hey, is there anything going on I should know about? Was there bad news announced today? Are people upset about this? Did the people who I'm going to be speaking to, did they choose to come here? Or is this like a penalty? If they're coming in thinking this is like a penalty, then I know, okay, there's something going on. It really has nothing to do with me directly, but that I'm going to encounter as I'm speaking. And that's all good background knowledge to get before you even open your mouth.
Right.
And I mean, there's more. The more that I know about why the vibe is going on, then the more that I can deal with it. Sometimes it's personal.
Right.
So I worked at Microsoft for a long time. And if I speak at other companies like Google or Apple or anywhere where there's people who have an opinion about Microsoft, the company, which there's a lot of them, I know coming in, they're going to have an opinion. They're going to judge me differently purely because I worked there. So I can diffuse that if I show I'm willing to make a joke about where I worked. I didn't find everything Microsoft did while I worked there amenable to my own personal opinion. If I can share that, I can diffuse that animosity. I can show them that I'm more like a person than they thought I was just by my bio or my background.
Right. Good.
Interesting.
Good stuff.
Scott, something that's not in your article specifically, but I hoped you could give us your insight into it anyhow. What if a presenter is showing up for their session? They're expecting, I don't know, 50 to 100 people. They get there and there's maybe half a dozen. I can imagine some speakers thinking, standing up proudly and saying, you know what, I'm going to give them my best, just like the room was packed. But I have a feeling you might have a different perspective on that.
Yeah, there's an entire chapter in the book, I think it's the fourth chapter, called How to Work a Tough Room. And it breaks down all the different things that can go on in just the room itself. It has nothing to do with you or your material, but things that in the room that make it tough to do well. That can be between the lighting and the microphone, between how the chairs are placed, but also with the arrangement and the number of people in the room. So the first trick I talk about in the book is if you have a huge room but only five people, the first thing you want to do is get those people to sit together so you can actually address them as a unified audience. Mm-hmm. If they're spread out all over the place, it feels kind of like a neutron bomb went off and the room just has this vibe of emptiness and no one can work well in that environment. So the first thing is just to get them together. The second thing, it took me years to get the confidence to do this, but the second thing, if I really have a group that's that small, is to drop my show, drop my slides, drop the prepared production, because that production was intended for a large crowd. If there are five people there, I can do something way better. They all showed up with a specific question in mind that each of them have, which is why they showed up. Wouldn't it be better if I just asked them what their question was and then answered it for them directly and spent I mean, if I have an hour and there's five of them, I can spend like 5 or 10 minutes on each individual person's question or issues and learn about them and give them a better answer and actually maybe teach them something directly that they can use when they leave the room. That's a way better value proposition for them. And I've learned over the years that it's actually a lot easier to do. If I know my material, I can answer questions. If I hear more about their situation, I can give more customized opinions or advice. And that's better, ends up being better for everyone.
Great.
It takes courage to do that the first time. But once someone does that once, it turns out that it's obvious how much better an experience it is for everybody.
Right.
Yeah. Adapting, being flexible in the presentation.
Being flexible, nice. Indeed.
What about the mind blank, Scott? The famous going in there saying, "Hey, I'm confident. I know exactly what I'm going to talk about. I feel good." You get up there. You don't even have your notes. You don't need those. You just left them on your desk at home. And then you realize, I have no idea what I'm about to say.
Yeah, this just happens. This happens to everybody. It's normal. There's nothing wrong with it. It doesn't mean that you've ruined the show. It's not like you are the president of the United States giving the State of the Union address. It's never like there's actually like a billion people watching you. If in that moment when you're pausing, people might think you're pausing for effect. They have no reason to judge you in that moment that you don't know what you have to say. So when that happens to me, all I realize I have to do is remember what the next thing is I'm going to talk about. And there's a chapter in the book where I talk about just – the book is supposed to be about confessions, but trying to be as honest as I can about everything I've learned about doing this stuff. And one key thing is preparation. When I prepare to do a talk, I work very carefully to construct it into units of time. If I have an hour to talk, I want to break that into five pieces where I have five main points I'm going to talk about. And I can blank out on the first point. That's fine. As long as I can remember the second point, and I'll just start there. No one will know about this first point. They won't know I skipped something. They have no idea. As long as I can latch on to the first thing that I remember to talk about and start there, I'll do fine. So whenever I have a moment where I blank out, whether it's at the beginning or in the middle, I realize they don't know what's next. They don't know where I was going. As long as at some point in the next 20 seconds or so, I remember another good point to make, I'll be fine.
It brings up issues of time. What if you're? I'm sure you've had an experience where you've gone in for an hour long presentation, and they said, "Oh, you know what, Scott, we're running a little bit behind. Can you cut it to maybe 15 minutes?"
Yeah,
no problem.
Yeah, that always gives always makes me really happy to hear that. Right, last minute. Oh, cut all the stuff you worked on down by a third. Right. Can you do that, please? All right, great. It's a similar trick. If I've constructed the material so that it's got five major points, then I can do a bunch of different versions of my material. I can do the 30-second version where I give a one sentence description of each major point. I can do that in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. I can then do a 15-minute version where I talk about each point for maybe a few minutes each. Or I could do the full-blown prepared version where I have slides and something to show forever, show pictures and all the background stuff for each point and spend even more time on them. So I try to through how I prepare and through how I construct the material that's actually not – it's frustrating because I have to switch gears, but I don't feel like I can't do a good job because my time has been cut. It just means the amount, the way I structure it, how much depth I go into on each point has to change.
Right. So once again, it's about being flexible. And I take it that if you know your material really well, it makes this job a whole lot easier to be flexible.
Yeah. It sounds like it's kind of funny. We mentioned at the beginning how there are some basic things that people overlook. And I think that's one of them. If some people spend so much time focusing on the superficials. What slides will you have and what typography are you going to use and what shirt are you going to wear, instead of thinking deeply about what kinds of questions you're likely to get asked about your material and studying them really well. And if you actually know your stuff very well, a lot of these worries go away. You don't have to be worried about questions because you thought through the stuff pretty well. You don't have to worry about how much time you have because that just means it's just less work for you. You'll cut out the points that are less critical to the material. But that's preparation and that's thinking and that's work. And unfortunately, a lot of people like to avoid those three things.
Yeah, right. Taking the easy way out when they shouldn't be. So, Scott, are these some of the type of things that we could find in your book?
Yeah, the book covers everything that I wish someone had told me about speaking before I started. And I've read lots of books on public speaking and doing research for this book, and many of them are focused on the perfect stories. They're focused on everything going well and how great some speaker did. You know, the Gettysburg Address comes up all the time. It's just fantastic. But in my own experience, I know that I've learned more from my failures. So the book goes into great detail as to things that have gone wrong for me on national television, on national radio, speaking to large groups, speaking to important groups, and the things that I learned out of those experiences that I don't think I could have learned any other way. And I think that's a much easier way for people to learn and gain confidence. So people like hearing horror stories, they'll probably really dig the book.
Great. Cool. And what's the name of the book and where can they get it?
It's Confessions of a Public Speaker. It's available on Amazon. It's done really well. It's got almost 100 positive reviews on Amazon already. It's available on Kindle and just about anywhere else that major books are sold.
Great.
Cool. Great. And your website, Scott?
It's my name, scottberkun.com. That's scottberkun.com.
Great.
Fantastic.
All right, Scott, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, and really good stuff. Great article, and keep up the good work.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right, you bet. Bye-bye.
Bye, Scott.
All right, everybody. That was Mr. Scott Berkun. And Ryan, if people want to leave us some feedback here on the Toastmasters podcast, how do they do it?
You can always give us a call at our listener feedback voicemail line, which is 1-888-451-8862. You can send us an email, podcast@toastmasters.org, post on our blog at toastmasterspodcast.com, or find us on Twitter at @TMPodcast.
Very good. Until next time, my name is Bo Bennett.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
Bye-bye, everybody. We'll see you later. Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.